He moved to California. That's right.
Okay.
Northern,
Southern?
No, no, wait. I had just moved to California when I did the early childhood healing practice.
Okay.
Northern California, Bay Area.
Bay Area, okay.
Yeah, so I did the workshop there. It was 13 weeks, so I moved out there, and I had to move out there anyway because I'd lost my apartment in New York City, and anybody who's ever lived in New York City would know how difficult it was to find an apartment again.
Oh, gosh.
And it was a sublet, and so the person who was subletting decided she wanted it back. So I thought, oh, more money, less light, less room.
Yeah.
So I moved to California, and I got, you know, what much more for the same price.
Yeah.
And California was so much more laid back and easy compared to New York. New York, they're just, they're really on a fast track.
Yeah.
Of course, now the Bay Area is getting more and more like New York because I think the population is probably largely from the East Coast now.
Uh-huh. And everything's expensive now, too.
And everything's expensive.
Yeah.
True.
Okay. Okay, so let's go back to the death of your mom and your dad.
Yes, thank you. So when I finished the the healing, I came back to visit because I already lived out in California now. And first I came back and my father had Alzheimer's. He'd already had Alzheimer's, but now he was going downhill. And I have to say that I made mistakes around my parents' death. My father died first and then my mother 6 months later from breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she had already had breast cancer, but it came back. I think she actually stayed alive to be there for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
I can.
But anyway.
Boy, I know. Yeah. It's amazing what we do. Yep.
So I made a lot of what I considered mistakes. I also, do you remember I was that ice cold princess, you know, the Aquarian who with not many feelings, and now all my feelings were online.
Whoa.
And I was blown away by the experience of losing my parents.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I was just stunned.
Now, were you and your mother closer than before now by this time?
Somewhat, yes, I would say so.
Yeah.
But even if you're not, it's, you know, the connection is powerful.
Yeah.
I can't say that we had, well, we healed a lot of stuff, but I still had a lot more work to do. And she was who she was. I have great admiration for her.
Mm-hmm.
Did I bond with her? I think that's something you have to do as a child. Did I connect with her? Did she care about me? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Was she a bad person? Not at all.
Yeah.
Was she a little self-centered? Absolutely.
Yeah.
What I remember was this, first of all, that I would keep on shying away from things that were disturbing, and I was still trying to tamp down my feelings and be strong.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this day when we were in her office. She was the toy designer. She actually designed toys that were produced by places like Gund and Hasbro and Sears. I mean, she and my aunt had actually infiltrated the toy business.
Wow.
And I mean, they didn't become millionaires, as my mother likes to say, but they did have an impact. And I think that's important.
Wow.
So we're sitting in her studio, and we're going through some papers, Xerox copies of drawings that she's done. And I hand her one of them, and I said, can we throw this out? I mean, she had multiple copies of everything, but each copy was different. You know, it was one of those crazinesses.
Yeah.
And I said, can we throw this out? And she looks at it, and it's one of her toy designs, one of her concepts. And she puts her hand in front of her mouth, and she says, oh. And she takes a breath, and she says, I guess I'll never get to that project. Oh, my God, it was like I had been hit with a cattle prod or something. I mean, I just pulled back like 6 billion miles. And I said, oh, I guess we don't need to deal with this right now. And at the time, I thought I was protecting her. But the fact is, I was protecting me. My emotions were not able to go to that idea of, oh, this is it. I'm dying. I'm not going to be able to finish this project.
Yeah, yeah.
And that that set things in motion in terms of what I did next after they died.
Mm.
Suddenly, I realized that we were mortal. That I was mortal, that I was that I had an expiration date, and that if I was going to do things, I had to go do them.
Yeah.
I couldn't just leave them aside anymore.
Yeah.
I had to find out what that was.
Yeah.
So the first thing I decided to do was to make a film, which became three films about.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. Yeah.
So that was the first thing, and that was scary because although I had had a community access TV, sort of like you have this community radio station,
yeah.
I had a community access TV show called On the Edge, and it was somewhat imperfect, and I, you know, a bit of a perfectionist, and so I decided I needed to make a documentary, and I didn't have a camera, I didn't have a crew, I didn't have any budget, and I just believed that I was going to do this, and I did.
Yeah, it's the way your brain works. It's amazing.
I just did.
Yeah.
I just figured it out, you know, and found the people to help me and found eventually the money to finish it, finish the films.
And so this, and so it was the death of your parents that brought you to this?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Because I wanted to figure out what it was about death that was so powerful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It is. It still is powerful because when we face the death of somebody, it takes us out of that everyday routine. It is larger than life.
Oh yeah, so
death is larger than life.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, this is the biggest mystery of our existence. This thing we call death.
So would you say that it was the death of your parents that draw you that drew you to what you're doing now? Would you
say?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So
that's what I made the films. Then I got involved with hospice in order to make the films real. And then I started, once the films were finished, I started doing workshops to share the films. And basically, in the course of doing that, screening the films, talking to people, in the process of interviewing people, I was really fascinated by this whole process of life and death.
So you really did begin shifting your focus then.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Wow. So what are trapped emotions, Michelle? What are trapped emotions? What? And I know that's what you work with.
Yes.
Tell me.
So if you go back to my story,
okay.
I trapped my emotions around my father. That's why I shut down my emotions or my feelings. I shut down my feelings because I didn't want to feel them and I didn't know how to handle them.
Yeah.
And we need to learn how to handle them.
Yeah.
And it tends to be in this culture or the dominant white American culture, because I know that's not true with certain subcultures, that we are taught to tamp down our feelings.
Yes. Yeah.
And so when we tamp down our feelings, there's actually... there are biological things that are happening in our body when we experience loss.
That mind-body connection.
Yeah. But and people don't realize it. They sort of feel like, well, emotions are optional. Well, they're not. And there's actual physiological things that happen in your body. And when you tamp that down, that energy doesn't get released. It actually gets stuck in the cells of the body.
It's interesting. One of the messages that I give my audiences is that we're not thinking people who feel. We're feeling people who think. And people they're surprised at that. And I said, oh, no. We're feeling people who think. That's why the trillion-dollar ad marketing world, when they advertise a car, they don't show you a table comparing the two cars. They show you the beautiful car on the beautiful road in the beautiful country with the beautiful girl, because they're tapping into your feelings. So we make the decision and then we go back and we rationalize it. But our feelings really come first. Yeah.
That's right.
And
that's
so,
right. It's,
yeah.
It's a powerful part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of our survival mechanism too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will explain a little of that. It's not the whole story, but it's a simple story. And that is that we are social beings, that as infants, we would not survive if we did not bond with our parents, if our parents did not bond with us.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have the capacity to survive on our own. We are not sea turtles.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we need our parents, and the bonding, and it's a chemical thing that happens that connects us.
Mm-hmm.
And when those bonds are broken, that causes trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And that longing to connect. And so when we lose somebody through death, mm-hmm. that bond is broken.
Hmm.
And it has a huge impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
And then the universe, well, not the universe, our culture tells us tamp our feelings down.
Yeah.
Well, they don't go away. They get stuck. And,
yeah.
And so we pretend that we don't feel, but meanwhile, it's those feelings, even though we're pretending that we're not feeling them, they're still in our body, and they're triggering thoughts in our head, which re-stimulate the emotions over and over again. And then we hold them down further. We create all this muscular structure to hold the emotions in.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by trapped emotions.
Trapped emotions.
I was talking to a woman recently who had been feeling guilt and remorse over the way in which her father died. And the thoughts are what hold it there.
Did she blame herself?
Yes. Well, her father had been put in a nursing home one of these senior
yeah.
homes. What is it? What do they call them? Board and cares.
Yeah.
And he was an intelligent man, and she felt that he could have been better, and she wanted to move him up near her. She wanted to put him in assisted living where he would have more of a quality of life. And she was never able to pull it off. And she loved him so much that she blamed herself for the way in which his life ended.
Oh, boy. That's amazing.
But she went on blaming herself for, like, years.
Years. Years and years.
And yeah. It's the mind. So it's this
the
interplay.
Mind. That's right. It's the beliefs. Right. It's what
it's
you say to yourself.
It's the interplay between the emotions, which she never let go of,
mm-hmm.
and the thoughts. And
yeah.
so the feeling sensations in her body trigger thoughts,
mm-hmm.
and the thoughts trigger feelings, and you get stuck
yeah.
into a loop.
I think one of the most exciting discoveries in psychology, which really occurred in 1961 when Dr. Albert Ellis wrote A Guide to Rational Living, and Dr. Ellis is regarded by psychologists as the second most influential psychologist in the history of psychology. Carl Rogers usually comes in at number one, Freud number three, and Ellis comes in number two. What he suggested in his book, and I was sharing this before you came on, is that our feelings come from our beliefs. And when he suggested this back in the 60s, psychology before that, they said, no, you're wrong. Your feelings come first. Like, for instance, when we watched 9/11, our feelings were right there. They were instantly there of horror and confusion and anger and perplexion and I don't understand and what's going on. But over time, our feelings about 9/11 and each person in the world gradually change because their beliefs change. And so the basis of your work is the fact that your feelings don't need to entrap you.
When we learn how to actually release the energy.
Bingo.
And here's the other key, mm-hmm. is that our bodies actually know how to heal.
Yeah.
It's our habit of tamping down our feelings and not letting them heal because we're afraid that we're going to get swamped by our feelings, that they'll overtake us, and we will never return to rationality again. We're terrified.
Yeah. Is that what you call stepping into your power?
It's one of the keys.
Could you talk about that? What do you mean by stepping into your power?
What I mean by stepping into your power is reconnecting to that brilliance, that seed, that spirit, that force
mm-hmm.
of life that we all come into this three-dimensional plane with.
Mm-hmm.
It's that thing that Martha Graham talks about, that energy, that vitality, that life force that's translated through us into action.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's the brilliance. That's the power. That gets tamped down because, like me, when I was a child, I believed that being myself was not good enough.
Yeah.
And so I hid that and figured out what other people wanted and kept on tamping that down. Of course, as we've talked about, the spirit does want to be released, and it keeps on throwing us these curved balls until we finally get it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Before you came on, I did Don't Worry, Be Happy by, what's his name, Bobby Farron. And I saw him. He's just a gifted musician. And I told my audiences, you know what, we all have a gift. We all have a gift of I've got the gift of teaching. Bobby and Ferris got the gift of music, and you have the gift of what you do. So we have all these amazing gifts, and yet I think that people hold back from sharing their gifts. Would you say that's true?
Well, of course, because we learn as children that it's not safe to be ourselves. We're brought up under conditional love.
Well, let's talk about that. I need to do this. Let's talk about that after this, okay?
Sure.
Okay, great. Well, listen from here. Okay, so we're talking about how our thoughts hold us back and our body holds us back. Can you give us maybe an example of how that can be true?
Well, oh my gosh, our thoughts can hold us back all the time.
Oh, yes.
In my own case, the story of my believing that I was not good enough. So if you're thinking you're not good enough, people are going to believe you.
That's
right. I mean, they're going to sense that about you, and they're going to think that about
you.
It's just the way in which you hold your body and the way in which you speak.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've run into these people who are so insecure that they're always checking with you to see if they're okay. It's exhausting. So our thoughts about ourselves impact the way in which we behave,
mm-hmm.
and they impact the way in which the body feels. If you don't feel like you're good enough, you're going to feel pretty bad,
right?
Because we need other people in order to feel safe.
Yeah.
We need to have their approval. And if as children we didn't feel safe, that need reverberates throughout our lives until we actually do the healing we need to do.
Realize
that we actually are quite capable of taking care of ourselves. We're not little babies anymore.
Why is it so hard? Why is it so difficult to change?
Would you repeat that again? Sorry.
Yeah. Why is it so difficult to change your beliefs from your childhood? Why it seems to be so hard?
Well, for several reasons. One, they are very deeply rooted. They've been repeated over and over again. And in my own case, remember, was successful for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were deeply reinforced over and over again.
Yeah.
And also, when we try and change them, we will often do things that will prove that we were right about that.
Mm, yes.
So I had a friend who had food poisoning, and she called me up and she said, oh, I had food poisoning. I was supposed to go out to lunch with this friend, and I asked her to take me to the emergency room, and she said no. And I said, well, Mary, why didn't you call me? And she says, oh, well, after I was rejected, I just couldn't do it again. I just got in a cab.
Wow.
And I said, well, was this woman the kind of person who would do that? And she said, well, yeah.
Wow.
So we choose the people who are going to confirm what our beliefs are. So that's the way in which we self-confirm.
Yeah,
we have to stay here. When we start to try and change our patterns, it will trigger fear. Because those things have kept us safe for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we start to do something different, the body will respond with a fear response. It will start getting nervous.
Yeah.